Welcome back to Plot Pit, the show where we forge fiction from fact and folklore. This is episode 2 of a 3-part trilogy with author Justina Luther, her second time in the pit. This will be her 5th appearance on the show. Hello, Justina. How are you?
I'm good. How are you doing?
We're doing great. John?
Doing good. My allergies aren't too bad, so.
Yeah, boy, mine were really kicking up a storm the other day. Today, we're talking about Justina's book Destiny's Night, available on Amazon as well as through an affiliate link we have in the podcast description here. And then we get a small commission if you were to purchase this. It helps our program. In the meantime, Justina, let's begin the descent. Tell us a little bit about yourself and your work.
So I have been a writer all of my life. I literally cannot remember an age where my brain didn't function in story, because I think that's just the way my brain is hardwired. I started writing for school, assignments and things like that. And then when I got a little bit older, it took off from there. And about 4 years ago, I published my first book, and it's been going ever since.
Now, you've got 30 books out, if I remember right.
You are correct.
Ranging from science fiction to young adult fantasy stuff here that we're going to be talking about today. You're really all over the board in terms of genre.
I like to call myself a squirrel on Red Bull and pixie sticks. I am everywhere.
Now, that is certainly a squirrel on Red Bull and pixie sticks.
That sounds like the title of your autobiography, I think.
That's a great title for that. Let's go back. You had said that you started writing in school.
I started writing in about the first grade for different projects. And when I got a little bit older, I just really fell in love with it. My parents and I had moved to Alabama. We were only supposed to be there for a year. And I made up my mind not to make friends. So my stories became my friends. I would kind of lock myself in my room and write for hours. And that was when I sort of learned to follow my imagination wherever it went, regardless of genre.
So I just want to throw in, since you said you spent some time in Alabama, you might find it interesting for future fiction that there supposedly is like a lost kingdom of Alabama in Alabama, as like funny as that sounds.
Wait, what?
Yeah, I wish I could remember the details of it, but I have this book. I'm going to read the title and the author. So the title of the book is Lost Lands, Forgotten Realms, Sunken Continents, Vanished Cities, and the Kingdoms That History Misplaced, by Dr. Bob Curran. C-U-R-R-A-N. I remember it had a chapter on a lost kingdom of Alabama that sounded kind of fantasy-like.
Interesting.
I think it had something to do with the Welsh. So you might research that, and maybe one day you can do, as odd as it sounds, something with the lost kingdom of Alabama.
Yep. Now I have the song Sweet Home Alabama stuck in my head.
As a great song. Now, you had mentioned that you spent some time in Alabama. You were only supposed to be there a year, and this is when you were going to school. How old were you?
We moved there when I was 12, and I had just turned 15 when we moved somewhere else.
So that's a very conscious decision to decide not to make any friends, especially at that age category. That's a significant maturity leap, I would think, for a lot of young people to be able to make a cognitive decision not to make friends because you're anticipating leaving there. What drove you to make such a bold move socially?
So for me, my mom was extremely good at her job. She was in retail, and she was the person they would send to different stores that really needed help. So I had gotten quite used to moving around at that point. In fact, we moved so often that when I would tell people that, they wondered if my parents were in the military. My response was always to laugh and say, no, scarier, retail. And so I really got tired of uprooting and having to say goodbye to friends. So I was just like, okay, it's 365 days. You know, I'll just kind of keep to myself. Then we can move, and then I can start putting down roots again.
So you move there when you're 12. You're expecting to be there for a year. You've already been moving around quite a bit. So with that said, you're at the end of that year. Writing has kind of become your outlet. Did you become friends with the characters that you wrote?
In some ways, yes, but I sort of didn't stick to my own word because I was homeschooled. So I would go to work with my mom from time to time, and you know, I'd put up sunglasses or restock, you know, whatever small little things needed to be done. And I ended up being friends with everybody at that store. So yes, I didn't have friends my age, but I ended up with a ton of friends. So what I would actually do, I would write, you know, one of my stories, and then I would take it to the store and pass it around to see what people thought. Not realizing at the time that they probably had to be nice because my mom was their boss. That never went through my head. I was just talking to my friends so far as I was concerned.
Oh, yeah. I bet they still enjoyed it, though.
And one of my best friends to this day was actually someone I met through that store. Girl has read every single one of my books and has been, outside of my immediate family, one of my biggest cheerleaders, still is.
So you've moved around a lot. You've made some adult friends then at this store. One of them has become, you know, quite the supporter of your work. What advice did she give you?
She wasn't a writer herself. She's an amazing photographer, and she's actually the one who took the black and white photo that I use on my website and several other places. She's very much an avid reader, and she just, her biggest advice was always to keep going. Like, the second she would finish one of my stories, the first words out of her mouth would be, I can't wait to read the next one. So she was very much that kind of gentle fire behind me, like, oh, yay, they're excited. I want to write another one. Yay, you know, type of thing.
You're 12 to 15 at this point when you first befriend this individual, and she must have recognized that you had a gift and a talent, not just a gift or a talent, but a passion to cultivate it. Did she by any chance push you to aspire or to become a professional writer?
No, that was entirely my parents. So, okay, story time real quick.
That's what we do on this show.
I know, I'm just used to saying that. Anyway. In the second grade, I had turned over a story for the Halloween story prompt we were given. And my teacher saw what it was that I do. And kids would be turning in maybe a paragraph, and she'd really have to poke and prod them to get them to do that. But she quickly learned with me, I'm at the back of the class, still writing away, you know, page, 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 page. So she quickly learned that I was the last one that she called on. And turned in this story about soul-stealing mirrors.
A soul-stealing mirrors.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
That was what I wrote at second grade.
Okay, so we'll come back to that, but continue your class story here.
So I turned that story in. She looked at it, and she saw that it was not of the usual level that kids turned in. And she actually called my parents in for the first and only teacher meeting they ever were called in for me. And they thought for sure that I had done something terrible. They're like, what did she do to cause this meeting to have to happen? My teacher sat them down and showed them the story and said, everything the character sees, hears, smells, touches, you are right there with them. She said, this is not normal for a second grader. This is a talent and you need to nurture it. So shout out to Miss Alcorn. You are one of the main reasons I am doing what I do today, because you were the first one to notice it.
That's awesome. I love that. And it's amazing how we have good teachers and bad teachers alike that really just shape us and encourage our talents, or, you know, because the good ones encourage you, then sometimes the bad ones, you need that bad one to rebel against and kind of sharpen your skills against them. So it's always a cool dynamic.
Would you say that Miss Alcorn was the most influential teacher that you had in your life?
I would have to say my dad was the most influential teacher that I had in my life, because I was homeschooled from the third grade on. So he was my teacher for many years. But as far as like actual in-school teachers, yes, she was definitely amazing. And she always was encouraging me to read and write little stories and all this kind of stuff. In fact, I remember the Thanksgiving before the Halloween story, I actually asked her if I could write the what is Thanksgiving like at our house from the turkey's perspective. She said no, but I think she already had kind of an inkling of what my imagination was like. And now I get it, because I don't want to read a story from a dead turkey's perspective either. Might be a little too scary for a second grade class.
Yeah,
just a little, you think? I could totally see that, though, as a pure social commentary on the dysfunctionality of the American family.
I don't know if I would have gone into that kind of detail at 7 or 8 or whatever I was, but yeah, absolutely.
So, souls stealing mirrors. Give us a little bit of a teaser on that one. That sounds fascinating.
I don't remember a whole lot about it, to be honest. But I do remember there were soul stealing mirrors. And I remember there was a little kid. I think her family had been sucked into it. And she had to figure out how to get them out of the mirror without being sucked in herself. But that is kind of the extent of what I really remember of that story. And unfortunately, that notebook has been lost.
Maybe on a future episode, we could take that concept and just flesh it out with you again.
I was just thinking what we need to do is get some very talented Justina acolytes together and recreate that story.
Yeah, get your fans to, maybe you don't want to get your fans to send in ideas, because that's a slippery slope where it's like, well, that was my idea, now I'm going to sue you. But in a perfect world,
I'm careful about that stuff. Like, even when I'm talking to like other authors online and they say, do you want me to tell you about XYZ idea that I have? I'm actually the first one to always caution them against sharing their ideas online. I'm like, I always talk to them and I say, you know, if you're in a writing community where you're looking the person eye to eye, that's one thing. You get a lot better feeling for people online. But in general, I try to dissuade people from posting entire plots or scene ideas and things just like on Twitter or something like that, because it's a very easy place for anybody to see it, grab it, use it themselves, and then you're in all kinds of hot water.
Yeah, and well, like in the past, I very briefly worked with a cartoonist named Doug Ogg for one of my books, Roswell, USA. I was going to use some of his cartoons, and he generously gave me permission to publish them in there. But I told him one day, I was like, hey, I've got this awesome idea for a cartoon. Can I share it with you? And he was like, very politely, he was basically told me, the minute you share your idea with me, I can never use it, and I can almost never use anything like it. So it kind of occurred to me. Yeah, it is kind of a dangerous thing to share your ideas with other authors, just because you can't always trust them and they might claim your idea was their idea. And so, yeah, it's definitely something to think about.
Which is one of the things that we tell our authors when they come here on the show, is that anything that you don't want being released to the ether that another author could take and use, don't put it out here. But that's what this show is all about, is, you know, our previous episode was, you know, we crafted a whole plot just off of brainstorming idea. But folks, for listeners out there, if you want to take these ideas and run with them, we encourage you to do so. But if you have something that you are specifically wanting to tell a story of your own accord, don't throw it out there.
Yeah, I guess that is one nice thing about our show, too, though, is if we put our idea out there and it's like timestamped, it's like that's proof. We came up with it on this date. We didn't steal it from so-and-so who maybe published their idea 2 years later or something like that. So,
yeah, that's why I am very careful. I only talk about what's in a book or different things like that after I have already written it, sent it into my publisher, and it's with the editing team. So, like, I have a paper trail of different things, you know? Isn't it sad that we have to be this careful?
Yeah.
So basically, folks, we've just argued ourselves out of a whole program.
Oh, no. No. Sorry.
Plot pit revamp. Okay, version 2, what do we do?
No, I think the moral is Justina needs to write the story from last episode. She needs to make that her next book and get it done before one of our listeners does it.
Oh, gosh. Not that I don't love the story idea, but I'm sitting on about 16 of my own now.
You know, so the authors that are out there, I imagine just like Justina or you or myself, we're just sitting on a treasure trove of ideas already. You know, so Plot Pit isn't the that venue where you would go if you're looking for an idea necessarily. But I would hope that this show inspires or maybe helps eliminate writer's block, you know, in a way that, hey, I hadn't thought of, you know, twisting something in this manner or using those type of resources or something.
So, oh, absolutely.
And at the very least, I would hope that story consumers and story lovers would enjoy, you know, watching and seeing. And I think that's really where the value of this program is. Show, don't tell, right? It's being able to watch a creative mind in action, or in our case, listen to a creative mind in action. I think that that's really just a very inspiring thing, to be able to sit and listen and engage with somebody like Justina, or, you know, we had Declan Finn, we've had Jesse Lawrence on, and here we're going to have Richard Polinelli and Rachel Haig. We've got other authors in the queue as well. So just being able to be in that presence of a creative mind, I think is just fun.
I love the way that you guys do it, because I bring you these, anybody brings you these simple little nuggets of things, and all of a sudden, oh, here's an entire plot line. And I just sort of sat back going, oh, wow, okay. Yeah, okay, I see it. I didn't think about that, but yeah.
Well, I can't imagine that anything we come up with on this program is ever going to be original, like truly, truly, truly original. I mean, I think everything's already out there, you know, that in the ether that could be told. Every story has already been done. Really, it's just putting your own spin, take, and originality to the voice of the story at that point. And
to me, that takes, oops, sorry.
No, go ahead.
To me, that takes a lot of the pressure off of it, too, because can you imagine how many first-time authors who are going, oh, I have to come up with something original. Oh, it has to be original. Oh, it has to be so unique. No, write what you've got. Do your best. Put your spin on the story that you've got. Like, that to me is about a 10-time lighter load than they started with.
So speaking to that, putting your own spin on a classic tale, right? Justina, you wrote Destiny's Night. I'm going to read the blurb here real quick and then tell us a little bit about what inspired you to take this story, the classic love story type scenario in the presence of a cruel king. Tell us how you were inspired to change this into something that was your own. Possessing the strength of 20 men, a knight will rise to rule the realms and slay the beast. For 500 years, this prophecy has been spoken of. It has hung over each king of Erebus like a specter, powerful, certain, and as unseen as the creature it speaks of. It has created animosity between those who rule and those of bloodline sworn to protect them. Each knight is the eldest son of his family and swears his allegiance to the crown on his 20th birthday, lest the kingdom fall into chaos, only to be put to death on his 25th. Such things have never bothered Princess Destiny, the spare daughter of a cruel king. She had no duty but to be beautiful and silent, or so she had been raised to believe. That all changes one night when Destiny steals away into the garden for a moment of solitude and meets Christian, the latest of her father's knights. He's kind and handsome, and as the hours slip by, they speak until the sun rises. With his kiss still on her lips, he tells her he wishes they had never met. Heartbroken, she asks him why. My 25th birthday is in a week, he says. Will Destiny be able to change his fate? Or will they be two more souls sacrificed to a lust for power?
So Destiny's Night came around originally as a flash fiction piece that I did on my blog years ago. I came across another blog that had posted an image that had all sorts of medieval and fantasy and different imagery on it. And they said to pick one detail and write a flash fiction piece from that. I did that. Person that put up the contest said they really liked it and to let them know if I ever did something bigger with it. So flash forward a few years later, and I find out a friend of mine is battling cancer, and she had breast cancer, and I don't have money to give. I can't do a lot, but I can write something to help her pass the time and maybe even be used as a fundraiser. So I start kind of probing her about what stories she likes, what kind of genres do you like, what kind of, like, what type of thing do you really love to read? And so find out she loves fantasy, she loves romance, she loves all this kind of stuff. And the little short piece that I had done that all those years ago pops back into my head. And I start sitting there and mulling it over, and Destiny's Night comes to be.
So started off as a flash fiction piece.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns into a complete book.
Two books, actually. There's a sequel. It's the Knights of Verberis duo. It's Destiny's Night and then Avenging Night.
How difficult was it for you to put yourself into this classic medieval sort of tale? And knowing the traditional tropes and everything else that goes with this, and that it's not a unique story, it's a unique voice or a unique telling, a unique performance. In your head, did you have to battle that at all?
I think since I've been writing for my entire life, that's not been a battle I've ever really had. Because when I first started writing, which is usually when things like that hit people, I was too young to realize that was a thing. Every story I came up with, I thought it was original. And by the time I realized that wasn't the case, I had been writing long enough to realize I love the ideas that I have. I love the art of writing. I love the performance of putting the pieces together to tell the story as I see it. So the fight or flight of make it original hasn't ever really bothered me. It's more of the fight of put out the best product that I can. This is the story as it's telling itself to me. Put down what I see going through my head. Put down the camera lens following these characters as they fight for their lives, basically.
So tell us about the characters in this book.
So, well, you have Princess Destiny, who is very much prim, proper, with that fire in her belly to be something more. She doesn't want to just be something to be looked at, but that has been very much the way she's raised. You're going to get to a certain age, we're going to marry you off for what use you're good for. And so she has that voice constantly playing in the back of her mind, but she knows she's smart. She knows she's capable, even though nobody will give her a second glance. And so she's got this kind of constant fight in herself between what she sees that she could be capable of versus the loudspeaker, so to speak, to put it in today's terms, in the back of her head of her father's voice on repeat. And then there's Christian, who is very much duty bound and all these sorts of things. And he's cut himself off a very long time ago from being scared of what life has for him. He knows the start, he knows how it's going to end, and he's more or less resigned himself to that up until Destiny pops up and they have their evening in the garden, and then he's suddenly like, oh, this is not what I want. It's what I need to do as far as duty is concerned, because this is what the kingdom requires of me, but this is not something that I want anymore.
Now, you've got the swearing in of duty at 20 and then the execution at 25.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us about the dynamics of that as it relates inside this kingdom and how it came about.
So a part of the prophecy goes into talking about when the knight will rise to slay the beast. And so the age at which they kill these knights does play into the prophecy, because the king does not want to be usurped by a knight.
How much do you provide in the backstory of this book?
In all of my books, I try to weave in a lot of backstory through conversation, through just different things, as opposed to there being one big flashback or one big, you know, this or that. The entire prophecy is woven throughout the book, as well as other things about the history. But basically, there's a piece of the prophecy that talks about one of the knights being the true ruler of the kingdom, and that part has been hidden. So all of the bloodline of the king do know that part, with the exception of Destiny, because again, she's the spare daughter, so why would they have her privy to any state secrets? So they're trying to keep, they don't know what knight it's going to be, and they're trying to keep that bloodline from taking power.
So classic tale then of paranoia in the leadership of the kingdom.
Very much so.
At least on that realm. And then you've got this strong, independent heroine who comes to the rescue of the knight, it sounds like.
She's very much looking at the history of her family, and she doesn't know the entirety of the prophecy, and that's not even really her concern. What she is more concerned about is putting right, as much as she's able, all of the killing that her family has done. She's looking at all of these innocent lives that have been cut down for the sake of her family not losing power. And she's looking at it and saying, this isn't right. So she's trying to do what she can to put a stop to it, not just so Christian doesn't have to die, but so that the man he's training to take his place doesn't have to die, and so on and so forth.
So you went pretty deep for a story that really, I mean, you were kind of writing for a friend. Do you ever feel like sometimes the stories that you're kind of writing not necessarily for other people, but just stories that maybe you didn't think you were all that invested in. You end up going a little deeper with those sometimes.
I don't think I've ever written a story I wasn't invested in.
Yeah, good point. I guess you've got to be invested in your own stories.
To me, it's a part of, I love to write twists into things. And if I don't know the background of a piece, I don't know how to twist it to surprise people. So background is one of the first things that I really work on. I don't plot my books out. I don't. But I do write out character bios and all that kind of stuff, including pivotal moments of their backgrounds. So like, did they have a death in their family? Did they witness something traumatic as a child? How did that affect them? What sort of psychological role has that played on them as they've grown? Destiny saw a lot of people just be trampled by her grandfather, by her father, by her brother to an extent. And she's just sort of sitting there watching all of these people be put under someone's thumb for absolutely no reason other than the status of their birth. And she just gets to the point where she says, that's enough.
So how do you leave Destiny's Night at the end and go into the sequel? Did you intend the sequel to exist, or did the sequel come up in your pantser writing style?
I had originally intended for Destiny's Night to be one book because I was trying to get this book out as quickly as I could. My publisher was very kind when I brought this idea to her. She was very much on board for me trying to raise money for my friend. And I was like, okay, if I can get it to you by this date, can we do the usual publishing schedule and have it by whatever the original publishing date was? That's a little too far back in my brain for me to grab at the moment. But she was like, yes, we can do this. Get it to me by then. I'll take care of the rest. I was like, okay. So I'm sitting there and I'm writing and I'm loving this story. And a little bit about my writing process. I see from one scene to the next as I'm writing. Like, I know the scene I'm working on and I see the next scene. But at other times, I also will see, like, in my head, I'll have like the next 5 scenes or so. And I'll see all of the little threads and different ways that they could go. And in this book, I was seeing threads with Christian's family. I was seeing threads with a possible second mystery that's going on with the kingdom. Mysteries with Destiny's own background. And all of these kinds of things. And I went to my publisher. I said, I can either get this book to you at a later time, which I really don't want to do because of the purpose behind this book. Or we can go ahead with this one as planned and I can do a sequel. And she kind of gave me carte blanche to do whatever I felt was right for the story. And it ended up being Avenging Night, the sequel.
That's really tough when you have 5 different ideas, all of which are really good and all of which work. How do you usually pick which one that you end up going with?
Oh, those all went into the second book.
Okay, cool.
So it sounds then, Justina, you're not following John LeMay's advice of picking one and tabling all the others.
No. I try in the best of my ability, even in, let's say, a simple love story, to have certain undertones and undercurrents and side plots, even if they're a little bit simpler, things that are going on around the main plot, because that's very true to life. Even if we have one insane thing happening in our lives, there's always little stories happening around us. So some of those extra lines that I talked about may not have been as big of a thing, but it was something that added extra stress on the characters as they were going toward their main goal, which to me makes for a very interesting read. Like, oh, they have to do XYZ and there's this big plot that's come up, but also there's this side thing that's drawing this character's attention away. Is their attention going to be split on this battle that they're heading into, type of thing?
With all of the background information that you write and that you try to weave throughout the story, as opposed to having, like, you know, chapter 1 is all about this character's background, chapter 2 is all about this character's background, you know, you're legitimately showing rather than telling. How do you keep track of that? You know, you've now got Scrivener.
Yay, I'm so excited about that.
Scrivener certainly allows for project organization. I mean, it's more than just a word processor, and I love Scrivener. But traditionally, how have you kept track of all of that background information for your characters, the world history, the scenes, descriptions of places and items or whatever that you bring to bear into the story?
So literally my process, I had two Word documents for every book that I would work on. One had my setting description, and it had setting description. It had a bio for each of my main characters, which included all of their physical descriptions. And then I had a backstory portion, which I would list all of the big happenings in their earlier life. And I would also add in any details, like if a former love interest that really mattered to them popped up in the story, I would add their name and any pertinent details to that backstory. So I always had kind of this running tally of information so that I did have that at my disposal when I went to the next book. I cannot say how excited I am to now have that all in one place, and I can just click it and I still have the story in front of me.
Yeah, one of the things that I find fascinating about the design of Scrivener and most useful is the way that the binder is all set up. You've got your manuscript, which when you compile is where all of the stuff goes out for the story. And if you're a researcher, a historian, or a statistician, or, you know, a scientist or whatever, you can still have your document, you know, your publication document, and then have all of that research material or background information separately in the left panel. And then, of course, there's the corkboard, which allows you to have, you know, a replica or a digital version of like a 3x5 note card that you can have notes and things on. And then you can move them around and do your plot threading and everything. And then another bit that's really cool about Scrivener is the ability to color code particular documents or particular items or particular note cards based upon a character or a scene or a subplot or something, to where as you're weaving things throughout the whole of the manuscript, you can visually see it based upon color.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be a lot. I'm excited to really get into it and dig into some of these features.
So yeah, Scrivener's getting a bit of a free advertisement here, but just hands down, I love this program. I bought it for myself. I've got it on the iOS and the app, which is a separate license you have to have. We've got you one now, Justina. I bought John one too, and John's grinning over there because I know that his personality is such that he hasn't tried it yet.
No, I like Scapple. Scapple's a little bit simpler, so I've used Scapple, which is pretty cool, but I just haven't really tried Scrivener yet.
Yeah, Scapple is the mind mapping app that Literature and Latte produces. And what's cool about Scapple, it's like $25 or something, I think is what we paid for.
Yeah, it was pretty cheap.
Are you saying Scalpel like the surgical tool?
Scapple.
Oh, okay, sorry.
So it's almost like Apple, but Scapple. But it's a mind mapping app. And so you can put these little boxes and diagrams and connect everything with lines and do what you need to do from, you know, like the plotting standpoint or just an outline or, you know, just a mind map of a concept or something. But what's cool is it integrates with Scrivener. And so when you import your Scapel document, it'll create all the note cards for you.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so one simple little feature that I was so excited to find on Scrivener last night, and you guys are going to think I'm absolutely insane, is it goes through and finds any double spaces for you and gets rid of them and replaces them with single spaces. I am a fast typer when I'm really zoned in on what I'm doing. I cannot tell you the amount of times where it is deadline day, I'm doing my final little teeny tiny make it pretty tweaks before sending it in. And I am looking at that clock and I am going through my book as best I can, looking for extra spaces. Having that be one button that I can just click and it does it for me and I don't have to worry about it, that made me ridiculously happy.
I absolutely understand. One of the little, so a little backstory for me, I'm also homeschooled. I'm a high school dropout and I ended up getting my GED and then went off to college, but that's another story. In eighth grade, we were tasked to write an essay. And this is the first time, maybe it was sixth grade, I can't remember, but it's about that time. You know, it's end of middle school, junior high, somewhere in there. It'd been like right at the start of junior high. And the teacher had asked us to write it in double space. And I didn't realize what that meant was you know, double space like we typically understand now, where the spacing is, you know, double between line to line. I thought mm-hmm. he meant that you needed to hit the space bar twice between every word.
No. Oh, no.
So I turned this in and he never commented on it, but my paper looked very different than anybody else's.
Oh, goodness.
So,
oh, goodness. Poor little you. Oh, my.
Yeah. And I still have that habit now of at the start of every sentence, I hit the space bar twice.
No.
Between every individual word, there's one space. But at the start of a sentence, I'm always hitting the space bar twice. And it one of the reasons why I use LaTeX or used. There are two ways to say that. It's either LaTeX or LaTeX, depending upon who you talk to in the science industry. But one of the reasons why I used LaTeX or LaTeX is because of the powerful opportunities that it has for typesetting and the extreme level of detail and control you get over it. It's one of my favorite programs, actually. However, it comes with a massive learning curve. It's a very niche programming language, and it's specifically designed for scientific writing. But what it does, it doesn't matter how many spaces you have between words, it will automatically put one space in between everything. So it's useful from that perspective, although Scrivener is by far my favorite writing software. I think that it was designed very, very well. It's very intuitive, but it does come with a little bit of a learning curve because you're not used to writing with such power. And the app is just feature rich. So there's a lot to learn, but that interactive tutorial will certainly get you through the most of it.
Yeah. The funny thing is, like, I went in last night and I was looking specifically for like the features that I use when editing. The rest of it I can figure it out and I'm not worried about it, but I was like, okay, where are my favorite features? I want to make sure my editing process will still be intact as I know it. So I was like, okay, where's this? Okay, found that. Good. Where's this? Okay, found that. Awesome. We're like looking for like all these little things, like having the book read to me, being able to find weed word counts, like all this kind of stuff. I'm like, haha, yes, awesome. Because I have cobbled together so many different little gadgets and gizmos over the years with Word in order to allow me to be the little editing gremlin that I am. So to see all of those in one place, I was so excited.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that Literature and Latte did a fantastic job with this application. I've looked into a lot of others. I've looked at Ulysses and, there's a plethora of word editors, word processors, plain text editors, and just overall, what I really do enjoy about Scrivener is the fact that you can put everything for a universe that you're writing in one project. And it doesn't matter if you want 50 books in the one project or the one universe or just, you know, a paragraph. And the research functionality and the binder, the way that it operates, and what's really cool is everything's just a document. It's how you structure the collection of documents within the project and what you call it. And it's fully customizable, even all the way down to the little icons. So I
saw that. I'm like, I'm going to start playing with those icons and then forget what I put on it and get myself in trouble.
So, yeah, I've actually done some scripts for podcasts in this and kind of had the outline of, you know, the season, what we want to do for Plot Pit and stuff put up in there. And it's just a fantastic program. So Literature and Latte, well done.
Very cool.
Well, folks, we've been talking with Justina Luther on the phone, author of Destiny's Night and the sequel Avenging Night, both out there on Amazon. We have affiliate links below in the description. These will provide a small commission to the program, which helps support us as well as the author, Justina Luther. Justina, give us your socials for our listeners and any final comments you might have.
You can find me on TikTok at Author Justina Luther, TikTok, Author Justina Luther, Twitter, Author Justina Luther. I'm on Instagram, Justina Luther, Facebook, pretty much all those places. You look up Justina Luther, you will find me.
You can also interact with Justina on our Discord server. We invite you to ping us for that.
Yes.
And Justina, tell us a little bit about what you think you might be doing soon on Discord.
Aside from, oops, should I have clicked that as I figure out Scrivener, I will also hopefully in the near future start reading a chapter from each of my books to show everybody a little bit of what it is that I do.
Excellent. So if you're interested more of Justina Luther's work, the way she writes, you just want to interact, maybe she'll give you spoilers if you ask nicely. Hit us up on Discord or any one of her social media platforms. In the meantime, if you have submissions for the show, if you want to be on the program, you can send us an email at submissions@plotpit.com. You can catch us on Twitter and you can look us up on YouTube. I promise you, content is coming. It's in the works. I have stuff ready to go. It's almost there. We're going to be starting a live Twitch stream soon. And I think that's it today. John?
I think that's everything.
Okay, tomorrow we have one more Pit session with Justina Luther. Tune in for that. We'll catch you around.